Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Jeff Kempeners, a top-ranking global executive, business strategist, and technology visionary. Jeff, you bring a lifetime of proven, world-ranking international business and technology leadership to our audience. Considering your heavy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, you know, we see all of this information in the news, and you see the conferences, this whole concept of cloud computing. So I want to drill into this topic in more detail. So can you share your views on cloud computing as a business imperative?
Sure. Well, I think, Stephen, we should probably start with the most important business imperative that a lot of CIOs and CFOs are requesting these days, and that is predictability. When you take a look at cloud computing, one of the great things about it is that it is highly predictable. It's predictable from a security aspect. It's predictable from a how much is my monthly spend. It doesn't require an initial capital investment to get a new service up and running. You've got service level agreements that give you predictability on availability and growth rates and scale and so forth, and all of that at a very predictable price. And that's, you know, certainly one of the things that people are very focused on in this economy is the predictability aspect of cloud computing. But even as we move forward into a better economy, which of course we're all hoping we're headed to shortly, it provides companies the ability to be very nimble and respond to their customers in an ever-changing environment. Upgrades sort of happen for free automatically in the cloud the next day you log in, and there's a new version in front of you, and you didn't pay, again, no capital expense, no project, no journey management or back-end integration. Now certainly there are, you know, there's a backside to some of that as well, or a downside to some of that curve, and that is that, you know, with predictability and cloud computing brings, you know, less ability to have control, right? So if you want to change very, very rapidly and very dramatically, you are obviously breaking your predictability model. And, of course, you would be hard-pressed to do that in a cloud computing environment. But for the right type of organization with the right size and you know, certainly organizations that are looking to outsource some aspects of their information technology, cloud computing has been a very powerful tool.
You know, I hear this term cloud computing, and I hear the term software as a service, and I hear about this platform called Azure. How does this all fit? Like, is cloud computing software as a service? Is that Azure? Can you give us some additional definitions and explanations?
Sure. Well, cloud computing it means many things to many different people. I think where we differentiate it, or where we attempt to differentiate it, is that cloud computing is sort of an umbrella term that may encompass infrastructure as a service, messaging as a service, maybe software plus services, which is one of the ways that Microsoft refers to some of the cloud computing initiatives they put forth. Or really true deep cloud computing, which would be more of the Azure-style platform, wherein you're actually using an off-premise server to do computational model-driven workloads, right? So those are things like, you know, data processing or business intelligence processing or those types of things. Messaging as a service, I think, you know, certainly qualifies. I think when people talk about cloud computing today, they tend to often be talking about things like BPOS, which is Microsoft's Business Productivity Online Services or Solutions. Sorry, they're also talking a lot about a hosted email offering, or really they're talking about software as a service today when they're talking about cloud computing. Software as a service can really be summed up as it is a packaged software application. That is potentially somewhat customized, that is either multi-tenant or single-tenant on the server side. That's not really differentiated, but certainly it's a packaged software product that could exist on-premise that many companies have installed and are using today that is provided as a service outside of your data center. And software as a service is certainly a big aspect of cloud computing. And then, you know, subdivisions of software as a service, you've got infrastructure services, messaging services, true application services, portal services, communication services, et cetera. So I sort of see it hierarchical, where cloud computing is really an encompassing term that covers all of those aspects, and then there are categories and subcategories within it.
Now, can we further explore IT initiatives with short and long-term payoffs? Like, what are your recommendations here?
Well, I think the short-term payoffs are clear. You avoid a capital expense and you avoid the project's cost. You also avoid the timeline. So with cloud computing, you're typically joining a data center that's in progress. So that's sort of a nice advantage. You don't necessarily have to procure and provision all of your own servers in order to get your service up and running. So let's say, for example, that I want to do outsourced CRM or customer relationship management. I might engage a company like Avanade to use Avanade Online Services hosted CRM, and I don't have to pay any cost up front to buy servers and buy software licenses in order to get that started. I also don't need to wait provisioning times vary dramatically from one organization to another, but I don't have to wait the 4 to 18 weeks, depending on how mature we are at it, to provision the hardware, get it set up in the data center, our base operating system installed, all of our security guys to give it the thumbs up, and then we're ready to actually start installing software and configuring against it. And then, of course, there's the development life cycle. Now we have to install CRM, we have to configure it properly, we have to provide the access, do the network bandwidth assessment, make sure it's available to all of our folks in all of our satellite offices and so forth. You contrast that to doing it in the cloud, and the short-term gains are pretty obvious. We don't have to buy the hardware. We don't have to do the network assessment because we're just going against the public internet. So, our point-to-point bandwidth is less an issue. I mean, I would still advocate for some bandwidth assessment. We don't have to wait for the server to get set up, provisions, security tested and so forth. We don't have to wait for the software to get installed. Really, we jump right to the end of the list, right to the custom configuration aspects of CRM as a tool for our business, and we basically start the development phase immediately, and therefore we get to the other short-term gain is that we get to the end result. We get a live system that is usable by our end users much more rapidly and with much less upfront cost. Now, the long term is quite a bit different because in the long term, we're talking about what does it cost to own and operate this system month over month, year over year. What does my upgrade path look like? What types of outages, excuse me, outages can I expect? Am I going to have problems keeping the lights on with this system? Are people who administer this system expensive or not very expensive? Are the processes around migrating me to the next version going to be complex or simple? Am I going to have to pay a lot of money to upgrade servers and software at some point in the future? And of course, is this a complicated system to manage? Are there lots of patches to apply and lots of things that I have to do? And those are decisions that people often look at in a traditional build versus buy sense, but now we're looking at it through a slightly different lens because you should, if your SLA is set up properly and you're working with a large global provider, all of that stuff really should be included in your monthly cost, with one exception, of course, being upgrade licenses. You'd have to pay for the next version, of course, because organizations that provide these services aren't in control of the software licensing. But certainly you would look to cloud computing to provide a significant long-term cost savings month over month, year over year, and what we sometimes call total cost of ownership, which is a much broader way of looking at it rather than just the tactical, what are my labor costs, what are my bandwidth costs, how much does it cost to have a server in a rack on-premise versus off-premise. If you look at it much more holistically, you'll see that the total cost of ownership can be really substantially lower in a cloud environment than it would be in an on-premise environment. And that's really the key aspect. Now, people would argue that there are trade-offs associated with that, and certainly, there are. Nothing comes for free. Your ability to integrate with back-end systems much more seamlessly, your ability to walk into the server room and hit the reset button if you really need to, is obviously inhibited. So there are some trade-offs that go along with going to an off-prem model, but certainly most of our customers find that the phenomenal cost savings associated are worth what are most people considering to be quite minor trade-offs.
So, do you have some stories that illustrate the areas we just discussed?
So we have a number of folks. I would say probably the best examples of stories in cloud computing take place in the software as a service model, right? So this is packaged software applications or messaging applications that live in the cloud and are hosted by some provider. I think the most popular among them today is probably BPOS, which is, again, Microsoft's Business Productivity Online Services. And that's sort of their cloud computing environment for things like SharePoint OCS, OCS being their office communication server, and of course, managed Exchange or hosted Exchange. So we've got, we've got a client in the UK, about 57,000 employees servicing about 45 million customers through 27 business units all around the world. So fairly complex organization that has, you know, multiple data centers and multiple locations, you know, certainly has a challenging sort of topology, if you will, from how they manage their messaging environment. They chose to go all in with BPOS. They said, we're going to put all of our, all of our eggs in this basket. We're going to go with a hosted email system. We think that it's going to save us a lot of money, certainly a lot of complexity. From the day that they officially decided they were going to go to BPOS, which was, you know, effectively the day they signed the contract, to the day that they globally launched the service was a total of 150 days. It's calendar days, not business days. So really we're looking at about, you know, what's that, 5 months, give or take a little bit. So over, you know, over a 5 month period, managing and migrating not just the 57,000 mailboxes, but group lists, resource lists, and so forth, and having all of that moved into the cloud, is a relatively quick turnaround time in order to start achieving a return on investment. Because that global launch in 150 days, that's also after what we sometimes call the two-headed time, right, when you've got some users on one system and some users on another, or where you've got literally two versions of Exchange, not two versions, but two clients of Outlook pointing to two different versions of Exchange during a transitionary period and so on. So all of that behind them, 150 days later, they were able to decommission the servers that had been set up for their Exchange environment. They were able to retire the bandwidth usage that had been allocated for it. And then, of course, they were able to take the folks who were responsible for those servers and repurpose those teams to look after some of the other more complex business initiatives that they were launching in both custom development and in their SharePoint environment. Now, the results were that, you know, they had domestic and international travel, was pretty dramatically reduced because they didn't just do the Exchange piece, they did the OCS and messaging piece. And so what they were able to do is climb in with a live meeting session. They bought some of the fancy round table devices and, you know, laptops that have webcams built in and so forth. And they found that their people were actually willing to do some of the business that they had been doing face-to-face via video conferencing. Which is interesting because we've been talking about that for the better part of 10 years, and I think we're finally seeing the technology simple enough, easy enough to use, bandwidth availability to be ubiquitous enough that now we're actually starting to reap the benefits of the vision that we had quite some time ago. There's also been a lot better visibility for diverse business units, so people all around the world have a much better visibility into their BI systems via the SharePoint. They have the ability to collaborate with other individuals who are in similar roles but who exist halfway around the world and maybe in an operational model where they would be sort of below the line of who would normally travel to conferences or to group meetings in order to collaborate. And then, you know, finally, the new ideas and innovation all is happening in a much shorter period of time because, again, those collaboration tools and those the ability to do really communications-enabled business processes and digital collaboration across very broad distances, you know, increased dramatically. And all of this was sort of bundled together under the, you know, what we sort of say is BPOS all-in, right, which is where you've got OCS plus Exchange plus Microsoft Office SharePoint Server. And those three together, the cost savings that they realized with moving their Exchange environment into BPOS is what funded the licensing to purchase the Enterprise CALs and the standard client access licenses for all of their employees for the Microsoft Office SharePoint Server environment, what allowed them to fund the project in order to create better BI, better reporting, and sort of better better visibility in their SharePoint and their portal environment. And then of course they flipped the switch and turned on OCS and communications enabled business process, thereby inviting people to do much closer collaboration with their colleagues. And again, the Exchange side was really intended to fund those other two initiatives. And of course, without spending any real dollars, 1 year later, they're already reaping the benefits from an ROI perspective. And now as they go forward, they've got a very inexpensive operational model with a lot of new capabilities. So they managed to increase capability while bringing costs down, which is certainly a rarity in these days.
So you touched on this somewhat in your answer, but let's explore this further. Like, what do you see as the top opportunities and innovations as an outgrowth of our discussion here?
Well, I would say I'd have to answer that market by market. There are some organizations that really quite like having a lot of IT around because their core business is IT. We sort of say if you no longer want to be in the business of IT, then you're probably an outstanding candidate for cloud computing. And what we find is that, there's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, and most people say, well, we're not in the business of IT. Well, be careful, because there are some organizations that you might not realize. Banks and insurance companies is an excellent example. Banks and insurance companies don't really have big vaults full of gold anymore. Nowadays, their systems are, the accounts are on mainframes or on online systems. Their policy management system is an application set. It's not paper-based. And so they really are in the business of IT. Their core business is run on information technology. One of the interesting things that we've learned is that some of these large organizations where IT is really a central part of their core capability and sort of their core competency, they quite enjoy having a large and diverse talent pool from which they can draw in order to find people who can best administer those IT systems that are mission critical. So they're less eager to go to a hosted Exchange environment, because every once in a while they get a tremendous bit of talent from the Exchange administrators that they hire in order to look after those servers, and they sort of pluck those folks from one team to another as they show their mettle and their ability to do more and more complex things as they move up the value chain in an IT organization where IT is mission critical. Now, if you move into the mid-market a little bit more, you start talking about things like hospitals, law firms, those types of organizations, universities, another great example. These are organizations that don't necessarily want to be in the business of IT in any sense, right? They just want this stuff to work. And there you'd see excellent candidacy for cloud computing sort of right out of the gate today. Certainly they're at the size of an organization where, a multi-tenant, or sort of the less expensive, version of cloud computing whereby you're actually sharing servers with other organizations. Some of them are willing to pay a little extra to go dedicated, where you've got your own servers and sort of are carved out separately. But the biggest opportunities in hospitals, universities, mid-sized organizations, like I mentioned, law firms, potentially, medium-sized capital markets organizations, things like that. They're starting with two things. One is collaboration, and the other is messaging, and they're really trying to lump those together to get digital collaboration and unified messaging all sort of happening seamlessly. They're less concerned with portals and collaboration, frankly, than they are with messaging. And then finally, as we sort of move up the maturity curve, there really is a tremendous opportunity for what we call, federated systems, which is the ability for us to share some information organizationally with other organizations that we choose. And then we're starting to get into the digital collaboration and portal space. So as people get more and more comfortable with this model, they're going to make it so that their OCS, I don't know if you've ever used OCS, but as a client tool, as an instant messaging tool, if I just start typing a name into the window, it's automatically searching my entire company directory looking for matches to the name that I've started to type. We at Avanade are federated with a couple of organizations, notably Accenture and Microsoft, which are our two parent organizations. So if I start typing in a name, it's also going to autocomplete that name with every Microsoft and Accenture employee who matches as well. And you can imagine how powerful that becomes for a sales organization, an organization that's really customer centric, or that needs to do collaboration across sort of corporate boundaries, or the ability to do that unified communication, not just within your four walls, but also with your trading partners, your channel partners, people who are upstream or downstream of you, and so forth. And that becomes a very powerful opportunity that, frankly, I think is still a year or two out, maybe even a little more, depending on the circumstances. But I think it starts with small and mid-market, non-IT-centric organizations doing messaging and collaboration, and then it moves up the value chain into cross-industry group and cross-company collaboration a couple years down the road as it moves more and more into the enterprise and multinationals.
So in this entire conversation, then, what do you see as the top risks for business?
Well, there are real risks and there are perceived risks. And that's one of the interesting things about cloud computing is it's very easy to raise a lot of objections. It's very easy to come up with a very long list of reasons why you shouldn't do it. And frankly, respectfully to anybody out there who's creating that list today, you're probably not the first one to think of these problems. There's a lot of folks out there who are thinking about this, and certainly the folks who are providing these cloud computing services have thought of these things, and I would encourage you to engage with a company like Microsoft or Avanade or Accenture to talk through that list, because each of those items is either already solved or is heavily mitigatable. And to get into some specific examples, I know that I would argue that here in Canada we have a very unique and specific issue around a reluctance to have cross-border data flows wherein our data is touching the U.S. So we're somewhat gun-shy here in Canada of getting into a circumstance where our customer or our constituency's data is subject to the Patriot Act. This has been a hot topic. There's some guidance on the Government of Canada's privacy minister's website about, what we should and shouldn't consider as safe. And there are even some guidelines around if you receive funding from the government, here are some sort of rules that you must follow and so on. And so as a result of that, really, we've seen a lot of reluctance to look hard at cloud computing because, frankly, a lot of the model and a lot of the cost savings comes from, real-time warm data center replication, which is to say, if a whole data center crashes, it's seamless to the end user because then they just revert over to another data center. You wouldn't know if the Salt Lake City data center for Hotmail was down, because if you type hotmail.com, you're going to get to your email. And it's the same concept in the hosted cloud computing world with the large multinational providers. They're replicating that data to multiple data centers in order to give you the high availability that you signed up for in your service level agreement. Now, I would argue, certainly with upper mid-market and above companies, and arguably, depending on the business model, quite a bit down market from there, that Canadian companies that do business in the U.S. with any substance are already subject to these, to the potential of having to hand their data over under things like the Patriot Act. The same is true of a number of European laws that are similar. There's a couple of laws in the U.K., certainly a couple of laws in the Nordics. That are very similar in the government's ability to come and ask you for specific data in order to protect their country. Really, it's not about financial compliance. It's about homeland security issues. Now, having said all that, like I said, I think a lot of companies are reluctant to go to BPAS because they don't think that they're subject to these laws already. And I would argue you should check with your chief risk officer or your information security officer, because chances are you're already subject to these laws. You've already got enough cross-border data taking place. You're already doing business in the U.S. or in Europe to the threshold wherein you would be subject to these laws anyway. And so you should not use that as a principal reason not to go to cloud computing. Having said that, you should certainly mitigate risks. You should certainly look for opportunities to minimize cross-border data flow. You should certainly ask the questions about, what happens if, right? You don't want Let's say, for example, you're signing up for a multi-tenant environment and you're therefore on a shared storage model. If somebody who is on a similar multi-tenant model happens to be sharing partitioned disk with you and they get their data seized, does the government walk in and wheel away a whole rack of servers and now you're offline as well? Short answer, no, that absolutely never happens. They work with the data center operators in order to pull just the data that belongs to the company that they're investigating. Even if they did wheel away a rack of servers, remember that, that whole data center could burn to the ground and you'd just revert to another data center. So if in a worst case scenario that did take place, you wouldn't actually see any downtime. It would just move to a disaster recovery model and you'd still be online. And again, just wanted to emphasize that, a lot of these are perceived risks, not necessarily real risks. And if I had to put my finger on the one real risk, it's that there is some trepidation inside of organizations to move to cloud computing because they feel like we're trying to put IT out of business, like we're trying to have everybody whose job it is to take care of these systems and to look after the day-to-day IT organization in a company. There's a lot of perception out there that the intent is to downsize substantially an IT department when moving to cloud computing. And I would say that that's not necessarily the case either. We really want to free up those people's time to look after more complex issues and to look after things that are a little bit more critical to the business and of course to address new market opportunities rather than spending as much money just sort of keeping the lights on.
So I guess it goes to this sort of equation where 80% of budgets are going into maintenance and only 20% in adding value, and you want to sort of reverse that equation.
Absolutely, and we find that 80-20 rule is out there, certainly. We definitely find that what we sort of call high-performance IT environments tend to be much closer to actually 40-60, where 40% of their budget is spent keeping the lights on and 60% is spent on new development and innovation. And interestingly, and this is somewhat counterintuitive, and there's some very interesting sort of high-performance IT reports and surveys that support this. But the very highest performance IT environments that only spend 40% of their money keeping the lights on and 60% innovating also have the highest rate of what are sometimes called failed projects. But they do that on purpose. They take more risk by developing more, by attempting more interesting business scenarios. And then, some of those just don't ever make it into production for good and right reasons. They say, okay, that was a good experiment, but let's try it again this way. And again, they've got the freedom to do that because they've got a lot more money to spend on innovation. And innovation doesn't always work, right? It's sometimes you get faced with a failure rate in an innovation world.
So, we've covered a lot of different aspects of cloud computing and so on. Are there any questions that you would ask, and then what would be your answers? Like, is there anything that we've missed here in this interview?
I would probably ask myself whether or not I would be looking at cloud computing, right? Hey, Jeff, if you were CIO of company XYZ, to what extent would you be investing in, and how aggressively would you be going after cloud computing today? Because it's fine to sort of speak about all these topics, but where the rubber meets the road, knowing what you know, what would you be doing? And I think I'd answer that question by saying, in true consulting fashion, it sort of depends. It depends on what size your organization is. It depends on how deeply you want to stay entrenched in IT, and it depends on a number of those other aspects. But having said all that, I would certainly be investigating departmental implementations of CRM. Right, so customer relationship management at a departmental level. I wouldn't necessarily do that as a company-wide initiative, but I would probably be giving individual departments localized budgets that they could then use to go after, to go after a new CRM system. I would absolutely be looking to migrate email into the cloud, somewhat aggressively and probably in relatively short order. I would probably be doing that in the BPaaS world because I trust large global providers, as a safety mechanism, and certainly it gives you a nice big throat to choke when it's Microsoft's contract. And I think you can rest, pretty much rest well at night knowing that they're going to make sure that things are working well for you. I would probably have MOS or Microsoft Office SharePoint server in the cloud already. If not, I'd be looking to move it there somewhat quickly. But I'd also have an on-premise implementation of MOS that would be for for very, very tactical purposes, the sort of crown jewel intellectual property I would want to keep on-premise. I would have already gone down the enterprise search path to make sure that a lot of the digital collaboration things that that we're doing are available and indexable via my search engine. I would not have moved my portal into the cloud unless I knew for sure that my search engine were able to index that content as well in a single indexer model. I haven't actually seen a way to do that yet, and so I would probably be sort of, poised with pen in hand, ready to sign that contract, but I would be waiting until somebody could tell me, yes, your search indexer can traverse the cloud and can come up to your hosted offering, and not via some separate search engine, but really a unified enterprise search. And last but not least, I would be looking to I would have put OCS in the cloud by now, probably at the same time as email. And the reason for that is because I'd be looking to find ways to federate with either, trading partners, potentially with large customers, people who place large orders with us, any of those types of environments where we can realize some additional efficiency I'd be looking to take advantage of. And that would be about it for now. Like I said, I'd be granting departmental CRM funding. I'd have corporate email in the cloud. I'd have corporate OCS in the cloud. And I'd be waiting to solve the search and sort of security aspects of the deep IP that comes with Portal. And once I felt those were addressed, I would probably be putting that up in the cloud as well.
Jeff, you've provided some great tips and insights in terms of the cloud and return on investment and some of the ideas and considerations and so on. So I appreciate you coming in. And we will continue to follow your significant contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
It's always a pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.